This is Jeff Traeger, who you may have seen this morning. He'll be talking about the rebirth of the knowledge operating system. And since he was so busy trying to get his type to curve out, we forgot to make a title slide. I'll mention this is joint work with Mike Travers, me, and JP Master.
And I'll just mention that Mike Travers refused to give a talk because he came back from Budapest, which is very reasonable. That's why I'm giving, insanely giving two completely different talks in the same day. This one will be slower, mostly because I'm tired. The reason for this circle logo is, first of all, JP made me have a logo. I didn't actually want a logo. But as you watch this talk, you will all have the feeling that you want to say, isn't this just X? That's why we call it the rebirth. Right. Because essentially, we integrate a whole bunch of pieces, and everybody will see a piece and say, oh, you know, that's just, why didn't they cite these smart people? But we think, maybe this is insane, but we think that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And that's sort of a hypothesis, which I take a vote on at the end. So the concept of a knowledge operating system, first of all, what's the concept of an operating system? Essentially, you're going to see a list of things that an operating system should provide, and tweak a little bit for what a knowledge operating system. The general idea is that you put a layer under all interaction, and I mean all interaction as you'll see, which constitutes this knowledge operating system. So it has to provide persistent object store, that is, I mean, you'll be familiar again with all of these things individually, a set of interconnected frames. It has to provide storage for data as well as knowledge, so you know, both ASCII and a bunch of and a frame system. Has to provide integration with programs built by others, which is a very important aspect that's often left out of system building. It provides persistence of the user environment across sessions, that is, you can like log off and come back tomorrow, and what you were doing is still there. You want to provide a rich, flexible, extensible scripting language, which I was going to put in parens, so that's a joke. I'll bet you can guess what the scripting language is. And provide the right amount of user integration, and what the right amount of user integration always depends on when you hit the wall. You can never quite get it right. It's to provide universal access for both users and client code. It has to provide access to remote services and databases, and it has to do this all in a convenient, integrated, user-friendly way. If you did all of these things, you would have, I don't actually know what you'd have, but you'd have whatever it is.
A knowledge operating system,
there you go. So what do? The NOAA's approach is we turn Lisp into an operating system. It's already almost an operating system, as you'll see, and all you do is essentially start with, we used ACL because it has a very fast, you know, a very nice compiler and nice multiprocessing model. There's a multi-threading model, technically. We run it on a server, which you access via a browser-based listener, which you'll actually see more of than you want. You integrate knowledge bases via a built-in frame system. You run it on Linux. This is actually a very important part of it. Some people just say that, but one of the big differences between old approaches to this and our approach to this is that by running it on a Linux platform, you can actually download other people's codes and integrate it. You have to rebuild a whole series of user tools that you don't have if you don't have the real operating system. I won't talk much about this. We provide XML RPC eval servers for others to call it, and you try to avoid crashing it because, and we'll talk more about this, we have only apparent persistence, which basically means things are persistent until it crashes. It turns out it's incredibly stable, so the apparent persistence is pretty good. Now, you're all saying, but, you know, isn't this just six other related projects? And that's the reaction that we always get to this. And it is, to some extent, six other separate related projects. The earliest version of a programming language turned into an operating system that I know of is APF, where essentially you could save your workspace and you'd have everything and you come back the next day and you bring it up. You didn't have your processes, but you load it up and you have all your objects. So essentially it's this thing, and since the 70s, APL has been like that essentially. Lisp machines, of course, is a classic example of this, except that I don't think they were persistent actually across turning the machine off and back on. But also, and this is a fundamental problem with the Lisp machines, is they couldn't actually run external code. You couldn't download a whole bunch of open source software and just run it on your Lisp machine. You had to reprogram it all in Lisp, essentially, or have some Lisp, you know, Fortran Lisp. Another part of this mission is Oracle, at least if you have the PSQL part of Oracle, is sort of like this knowledge operating system, except that it's a relational model. There's nothing wrong with a relational model if you have tables, if you, you know, put your stuff into tables, but we like putting our stuff into frames and lists and that kind of thing. So in a sense, we want to rebuild that kind of feel with more of a Lisp underpinning. I don't know whether any of you have actually sort of used Oracle in this way. You can just log onto it, program, you know, code into the Oracle thing. MATLAB and Excel also have this idea of end-user programmability that you'll see more of, and Mike actually has a lot more to say about the relationship between this and MATLAB and Excel. There's a project called Framer D, which is close to this idea of Ken Haas at the Media Lab. And then there are a whole bunch of things that people are sort of envisioning that are similar. There's two very nice projects, Eros and Kyotos, which have this sense of total persistence and an integrated programming language. There's a project some of you may know of called Tunes or iTunes, which is almost exactly the same vision, but nothing is implemented, essentially, which, you know, paper is easy. And then there's the infinitude of random persistent object gizmos. So essentially, every time I talk to anybody about this, they say, oh, you know, yeah, this, we have this persistent thing over here. But this isn't just a persistent thing. Again, it's the integration of different gives it its power. So what I'm going to do here is give you an overview of what it looks like to talk to the knowledge operating system. I'll give you two examples. One is this thing called Biolingua. Actually, there's another paper in there on Biolingua, kind of accidentally. So we got two papers for the part of one talk. Then something called CASH, a little more briefly, which is this collaborative knowledge analysis system, which is a different implementation of the knowledge operating system using a different domain. And then talk about issues and approaching near-term goals. So, overview. What's it look like to actually deal with this thing? We start with ACL, as I said. I'm not going to talk more about that. Run it on a server, access via a web-based listener. What's a web-based listener? Well, a web-based listener is exactly what it sounds like. You can do this right now. You can open up. I'm not going to tell you the address. Oh, shit. I'm not going to tell you the address because you'll immediately go and do it. Don't do it. Yeah, I mean, you can do it if you want. In fact, you can follow along this talk by actually. You open up your browser, download nothing, and you get a Lisp listener. You can do your homework. All right? And it has two different places to put expressions. There's a simple expression and a complex expression. The only difference being that the simple expression is when you hit enter, it does them, and enter is sometimes useful if you want to write long pieces of code. So that's the only difference between these two. There's also other gizmos that I'll get to, basically, parent matching and stuff like that. But this runs entirely in your browser, no app. The results go up the top, and you'll notice that all those things are blue, essentially. We have this, we're after this, everything is clickable model. So, you'll see a lot more of that. We integrate knowledge bases via built-in frame system. This is a very hairy diagram you'll see a lot, but I'll show you different things when I'm in different places. So what you're looking at here is the listener is the front that you see before with some output or something that you'll understand by the end of the talk. And the back is a piece of the frame browser. There are three ways into the frame browser. Of course, from the frame browser itself, you can link to the frame browser. This will go to the top of the frame browser. So there's an integrated knowledge base underneath this when you open up your web browser. It's a whole integrated knowledge base. And also, you can get to it from the clickable parts of the results. So let me show you this. This is a cool trick you can play on these slides. I'm going to click in the frame browser. So this is now just the top of the system. Now this is Biolingua, which is actually built to be an integrated biological knowledge base. And so we thread what we call threading, which is essentially you pour the knowledge into the system and then you figure out what the connections are between the nodes. And you put the pointers in. So we have the gene ontology, which you've heard a little about before, if you were in my talk or Marcus' talk. PEG, different kinds of knowledge bases, and then there are organism frames. When we build them for multiple organisms generally, and so all the organisms are threaded to each other. That's a very important part of the power of this. Just say, whoops, I didn't do that. So I'm going to go to the KEG enzyme frame, and of course, you all understand that's not okay. Sorry, I just ruined a lot of people's day. Now I'm just going to give you the sense of walking through the frame system. Again, this is just all running out of your browser, or my PowerPoint at the moment, but you can do exactly the same thing with your browser. So this is a set of, these are all the subclasses of this abstract, KEG enzyme frame. So all these are enzymes. We go to this one. This is now a particular enzyme which is described, has various slots and values. And we can walk through the knowledge base into, various kinds of information about this object. There's another path into this. You'll see some of these over and over again, so I realize I'm going fast, but you'll be used to it by the end. Another path into this is that when you get results, if the results actually have frame content there, because they're in the history, you can click through into those as well. So you can just click through into this one, and you're back in the frame system. I keep wanting to scroll. You're back in the frame system, and the Notice this is actually, so this is a gene of an organism, so it's the SLR1418 gene of this organism synthesis, the 6803, and it has gene ontology bindings as one of the slots, and the value, so ATP binding. So now what I'm doing is I walk just over the gene ontology. So the gene ontology is threaded into the system, and this is essentially permanent. That is, the users always see this when it comes up. You don't have to load anything, you don't have to kind of get yourself in the right knowledge space or any of that. You just log right on and you're in knowledge world. And then, of course, you can basically, So we run it on Linux. External tools and a security model adopted from Linux are the important features of this. You never see Linux, of course, but it's important. And the reason it's important is, back to this example, let me explain this example a little bit. This is doing phylogenetic tree analysis. What we're going to do is, this little piece of code here actually calls out three different times into downloadable pieces of code, although it's essentially invisible. So it calls this program called cluster all the text genes and align them. It takes the result of that and calls this program called phylib, which actually creates phylogenetic trees. It takes the result of that and calls this classic AT&T layout algorithm called Dottie, and that's the result of Dottie. So the underlying machinery that you would have to spend all your time sort of hacking together is I'm using the word thread in a different sense, is essentially invisible in the functional machinery that has been built by somebody to do this kind of work. And it works very smoothly from the user's point of view. So we need to rebuild a bunch of user tools. We have our own file browser onto the file system. We have our own, this is just displaying a piece of list code, but the thing to notice here is that because this is all coming out in HTML, we did a kind of cute thing, which is if you push this, these are hot links. If you push that button, that's a piece of internal code. So it's like a list machine in the sense that you can walk through the entire code base. That'll walk into the internal list code, and the purple ones will walk out of the haystack. So you can essentially explore, and this is the way you use it. You explore the whole, essentially explore the whole code space.
You can do that from this browser window.
From this browser window.
Yeah. Click on the function, and you will go to the definition of that.
Yeah, exactly. You can also do it from the help that I'll show you in a minute. It has an editor, and the editor is integrated in such a way that you can edit your code, save the file, load. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to rebuild Emacs in JavaScript. So if anybody has an Emacs in JavaScript, please let us know.
Lisp in JavaScript, is that good enough?
There is a Lisp in JavaScript. I'm sure it's hell slow, but we'll get back to it. Of course, the forever war of documentation. There's extensive amounts of documentation. The only thing I wanted to show you here is that the documentation is dynamic, so if you define primitives and export them, then they become a part of the documentation. Right? So essentially, users can define primitives, which become a part of the system, become a part of the documentation, just essentially invisibly for all other users and individual file systems. I'm not going to talk about the XMLRPC server or we'll talk a lot about parent persistence in a second. So I'm going to give you this bilingual example. Historically, we built bilingual first, and then picked up the knowledge base and ripped it out and built cache, which I'll talk about, and then we said, maybe there's an abstraction here, and that's this thing called knowledge operating system. So the bilingual vision is to enable biologists to actually program, and the thing was, I went to the biology lab, as I said earlier this morning, and I was programming a million one-off little hacks for biologists. I said, screw this. I'll build them an integrated environment and they can program it themselves. Right? It turned out to be less possible than you think. I thought it was possible. We'll get to how possible that is. But that was sort of the idea. We have to basically make the scripting language, the programming language, meet the biologist halfway. Okay, now whether we met it at the appropriate halfway is an open question. It's not an open question. It's not true. It's a closed, false question. So this is current best practices in bioinformatics. Okay, current best practices is essentially everything is kind of all over the place, and you download it maybe, or you get it through soap or shampoo or whatever way you get it, And there are like 11 zillion different programming systems that all connect it. So the bilingual version of this is these things aren't that big in most cases. Just download them, okay? Put them in the way you want them with respect to each other, thread them all together, as I was sort of showing you, right? And then there's some things you have to call out, like the Stanford microarray database that Marco was talking about. We don't obviously download that because that's a huge data system, we can still call out the things. And then provide this nice integrated vision so that you never have to think about where I'm going to get my knowledge, right? The knowledge is just in the system permanently. Like, you know, you can just touch it.
The prime directive in bilingual was that all data and knowledge can be manipulated by these user-written protocols, programs, and they approximate users' natural protocols. Right? Well, so here's a user's natural protocol. This is actually not quite a user's natural protocol, but it's very close. It's a real problem for real biologists. Essentially stated the way the biologist would state it, although, you know, with some cleanup to make it fit on one slide. And the goal, which doesn't quite work quite this simply, although this code almost actually works, is code that's slightly longer than this really works, is to be able to essentially, you know, write a piece of code that does that. And so we want to be able to access the slots of objects and, you know, loop over the genes and things like that. And I'll show you a little bit of this. And not be very far off from the way that they would, you know, think the code. So this is, now I'm going to go through a couple of turgid examples, which will not actually look like anything you couldn't do in your, you know, just bringing up your Lisp environment, except remember, this is on the web. You can do this now. You could actually, like, open this thing and follow these things through without ever downloading or starting any up. So this is start on the second, I wish I had a Lisp environment, but it basically, oh, I can use this. Well, anyway. So there's a set of organisms that are loaded in the system. These are the organism frames at the top. I just want to count the number of genes in a particular organism, so I get one of the organisms, which is Cystis 6803, and I get its genes, and I just have the list of genes, and I get the length of it. Okay, that's a pretty straightforward thing. But now I want to do something more complicated. Remember I said that we have this, the genes are represented by frames. The frames have slots. One of the slots is the thread over to the gene ontology, right? So you want to say, well, which of these genes are transporters? One way of asking that is, which of these are sort of under the transporter node in the gene ontology? So you just say, so this is, you know, recognizable piece of list. It's essentially that long. You just say, remove if it doesn't have a transporter in its go frame. So these are the genes that are transporters, right? So this is the kind of thing you show to biologists, and they go, holy shit, that, you know, I do that with Excel, and it takes hours, and tell them these kinds of things. It's not that hard if you have the whole thing pre-integrated and threaded, and you have just very simple language on top of it. I'm going to show you one more complicated one. This is glycolysis. Glycolysis is a meta-reaction. If you're a biologist, you know that glycolysis is the thing that takes sugar and essentially gets ATP and, you know, various other energy sources out of it by breaking bonds and, you know, using energy for other things. And glycolysis has a bunch of other reactions in it. This is the list. This green thing is the list of the other reactions. Don't worry about the names of them. They're just pointers. These are pointers out into the biopsych model, right? So biopsych is Peter Karp's, you know, SRI, big database of pathways. We've just downloaded it, built it, you know, built pointers into all the rest of the frame system. So you can do very simple things. So you have the left and the right. You know, if you write a chemical reaction, like the left of the equal sign, the right of the equal sign, those are those two things at the bottom. And so with a very simple expression, you can just say, ask which genes are members of the glycolysis, and now we can write a little function. Where is it? Down here, where I want to define something for a gene that extracts the reaction. So it just goes in and finds the product. I'll read this backwards, right? You can read this. It's finding the product of the gene. It's finding what that product catalyzes. Remember, genes actually create proteins, and proteins are the catalysis. But that catalyzes the reaction. That catalyzes we get the left and right of the reaction. That's the answer. And then you can map that over all the genes. Oh, this thing. This obscure hop thing just means the output of the history output of 38 successful genes. This now, if you export it, becomes a permanent part of the system. Everybody else can use it. Right? Doesn't look like much if you were just loading this stuff up. So now I'm going to run again through this. So I need to tell you a little more about it. Again, I said you'd see this a lot. You'll understand it by the end. So I think you'll hear a lot more about phylogenetic trees later on. But essentially what this is doing is, a very common question that biologists have is, what organisms evolutionarily related to what organisms? And the, you know, one version of the answer is they make a tree that says these two organisms are more closely related than this is to say this one. They want this one. It's the ordering, sibling ordering doesn't matter. And the interesting thing is that that's typically done using ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA is highly conserved. But the point is they want to be able to ask this for lots of different subsystems. So maybe the phylogenetic tree looks different if you use different subsystems. So just this much code enables you to do this over any gene ontology category. Right? So you say, I want to see how a phylogenetic tree looks if you do it over acyl coenzyme A dehydrogenase, or anything else you want to, you know, pick. So you get the
There it is. You get the go-related genes of the goat, which is that thing. It's covered with arrow, but you pass them across all. Again, this thing again. You pass that to phyla, which gives you the tree. You display the tree, and you're done. And now you can obviously see that you can take this tree, which you actually get as an object. If you don't pass it to Dobby, you get the tree rather than a picture of the tree. And you can take the trees, do it for every Go frame very easily, just by mapping across all the Go frames, and then do some kind of a graph comparison to compare the trees with each other, like average the trees or something, which is actually common and done with bootstrapping. Now, lest you think that biologists actually can't do this, and lest you think Lisp is the wrong place, but the wrong way to do this, there's a biologist, probably our heaviest user, named Jeff Eldai at Virginia Commonwealth University, and he actually teaches biology to his students. And he has a set of students that have built a sublanguage, an entire sublanguage. He doesn't like quote. All right? So he decided to get rid of quote, right? So he went macro crazy and built macros and just created a whole new sublanguage, all right, called BioLite, BioLite. And it turned out that a fellow from, so there's a project, the kind of what's it called? Napster of genomics is a thing called the seed. So, like, it lets you share your genomes across everyone. And it's programmed in, guess.
Java.
No, try again. Perl, right, okay. Whole thing's programmed in Perl. So, Rick Stevens, the guy, this is Rick Stevens, yeah, the guy who co-developed it, Eldai said, I can do better than you can. Right? I don't know under what circumstances, but this was like, you know, extreme biologist programmers. And the interesting thing is that one of them actually isn't a biologist. This guy, Rick Stevens, is only partly a biologist, he's more a programmer, right? Eldai's just a biologist, right? Except that, you know, he knows macros really well. It's like macro insane. Anyway, so hyper macrogenic. Anyway, so he said, okay, I can do better than you. Show me your code. So Stevens gave him this challenge problem, right? He said, find the 100 base pairs, that is the 100 nucleotides, you know, AGCT, et cetera, upstream of a gene. That's usually the gene control region, right? As we were talking about earlier, So this is a challenge problem from Stevens, okay? And it turned out that without making any changes in the system, so this is Stevens' program to do it, which is, you know, arcane, but that's just Perl. I mean, you can sort of vaguely see what it's doing. What he's doing is, you know, scripting the Linux system, okay? So Eldai said, oh yeah, I can do that, and did it in this much code, with no changes to the system, and you can just read essentially what it does. He said, and this is BioLite now, and the only difference is you'll notice things, and you sort of notice little weird things like length doesn't have a colon on it, and that kind of thing, right? So he says, for each gene in the genes of, this is more than name, presumably that goes in $1 there, okay? You get the orthologs. Remember, orthologs are the things that are the same in different organisms, right, with the genes. You find all the orthologs of this gene. You find the upstream sequences, right, of the orthologs 100 up. And then you align them and you collect the alignment, right? And this is actually something biologists, in fact, a biologist walked into my office last Wednesday, was it? And wanted to do this exact calculation. And she put me on a paper, so I'm like now on a paper for writing 4 lines of code, which somebody else has already written. but, you know, with Excel and, you know, anything else you can imagine her doing this with, it just would have been impossible. So enough about BioLite, where there's, as I said, there's accidentally a second paper in the proceedings as well as a bioinformatics paper in the Journal of Bioinformatics, which is the same paper as another. Don't ask me how that happened.
We didn't submit it, actually.
So BioLite integrates genomic data analysis tools, integrates organism-specific as well as general knowledge, unifies the important knowledge bases. Someone else wants a knowledge base we don't have? Fine. We pour it in, figure out the threading, and it's there. Right? Another tool, you want to download it? Fine, download it, write about, you know, this much interface code, and it's part of the whole system. Oh, by the way, everything traffics in frames. So the sort of fundamental object of the frame, so BLAST, which, you know, phylib actually gives you back a frame object, which is, you know, represents the tree. So, you know, since everything's trafficking in frames, everything called frames, it's all sort of very natural. Offers this flexible open programming methodology, the level of open programming. Someone, apparently that phrase has been borrowed now. Extreme open programming. Provides this convenient user access, by the way. But it doesn't touch on two of the really important properties of, one of the really important properties of the knowledge operating system, which is this collaborativeness. So cache is a different application, let me describe it. So there's an analytical technique that that unnamed agencies use called analysis of competing hypotheses. right? Basically, analysis computing hypothesis is a big phrase for decision tree, decision matrices, or maybe decision matrices is a big phrase for analysis computing hypothesis. But anyway, it's just a totally obvious thing, right? We have like some, this is about the Washington sniper problem or something. So you have a bunch of evidence here, you have a bunch of hypotheses about what's going on there, you have like this means that this piece of evidence is highly consistent with that hypothesis, etc. You score them. We didn't do this, this is just a bunch of Java hacking. But the point is, it's not the right model. Okay, it is not the right analytical model for this kind of problem. The right analytical model is more like a Bayesian influence net. So how do you get a Bayesian influence net out of this thing? Right? The answer is, it's a community. You have to keep in mind that there's a community of analysts that are actually doing this, a huge community of analysts in some cases. In biology, there's a huge community of biologists all working on, this is what I was talking about this morning, working on the problem of, you know, what things are what and how they, so imagine the community of these people doing it. Cache the collaborative analysis of computing hypotheses. You imagine the community of these people doing it. You want to, in an intelligent way, pipe incoming evidence to whomever it will be most relevant to. Then, and this is the key, you use this sort of client-server architecture of a knowledge operating system to enable all these people working in the same list space, even though they don't know it. Right? So they don't have to know it. The point is that they can, so one of the fundamental things is that one person's hypothesis is another person's evidence. Right? And they want to deny this fact, but it's a fact of the universe. And this is what I was talking about earlier, where people, you know, are basing their results on somebody else's conclusions. Right? But if we reify that, if we enable you to actually, you know, see that in a useful way and capture it, essentially what you get out of the community from every person doing a simple decision matrix is what amounts to a Bayes net. Right? You can kind of see that if you take these lines as a simple case. If you take these links, this thing is a bipartite graph. Right? And this is a link between two bipartite graphs, so you end up with this, you know, sort of tree of bipartite, DAG of bipartite graphs. So how does cache work? Cache looks exactly like that ACH thing. So the way we built this is, you don't see it here just because I cut it off, but you have that listener, you know, gizmo down here. So it's the same exact environment. It doesn't have to be, that's not really relevant, but you have incoming intelligence, which is scored semantically with respect to your problem. And then you get it in the order that it's most relevant to you. And both have intelligence hypotheses are linked to the underlying knowledge base. So if you push that link, what do you get? I hope. I'll try it. You get a pointer into the frame system, right? Essentially, we've pulled out the biological knowledge, poured in a, you know, a more like a common sense knowledge base. So this is something about, I don't know, an example, like shooting. Has something to do with accuracies and victims and ranges. And this thing now goes out into Sumo, which is this huge, you know, psych-like thing. I'm not going to walk through all of that. That's another talk. The frames represent the concepts. And by virtue of that, you can score intelligence, that is, evidence, with semantic distance to queries. So some terrorist was arrested in Madrid. You select semantic distance scoring. It's all linked into the knowledge base. Just like the genes of the organisms are all linked into the knowledge base. And so, through some kind of spreading activation algorithm, you end up, you know, getting scores of how relevant the stuff is. It's sort of by score, and you can add what you can. But the important part of this is that you're able to now take pieces, sort of subproblems of the analysis, and link them together. Well, how do you do that? Well, what happens is one user, these are two different users, they don't know about each other, except that the semantic distance scoring thing, well, we'll see. So this guy says, look, I think there's this fairly important hypothesis. I think this is an important hypothesis, right? And so I'm going to promote it. Basically, what that means is checking it in as a piece of public evidence, right? So put it in source code, in a sense. It makes it available to everybody. And then it'll get piped to everybody else to whom it's relevant. I said that. I may have said that backwards. And so they now have access to it, and if they select it and put it in their problem, they basically built a virtual link between this matrix and that matrix, and if this person changes his or her scoring, you know, her belief in it, it will automatically actually change the scoring up there. If you do this with 100 people, you get essentially a Bayes net that amounts to a Bayes net and send them a copy of a Bayes net. So this takes advantage of knowledge operating platform in a different way. What's important here is integrating a community. They don't know they're all in the same listener, you know, environment, okay, with the same underlying knowledge frame system, and that they're all talking to the same machinery, right? But they're shared, you know, we have this semantic knowledge base built into it, and it's exactly the underlying machinery changed, not at all, okay? In order, we just pulled out the knowledge, put in the common sense knowledge base, change the display so that instead of phylogenetic trees, you get, you know, decision matrices and a couple of interface problems, and you're there. This one does not have a demo server. You noticed I went through quickly, I'm backing up, that this one, although I didn't make a big deal of it, we have a free demo server, which you can log into right now, and you'll be able to do everything I'm doing here. And this, of course, all open source software. This one does not, it's not open source software, that is the surface layer is not open source software. The app, as it were, is not open source software. And there's no demo server for it. So, issues with this. Is this a good idea, or is this a bad idea? Well, as you can imagine, it's both a good idea and a bad idea. So pure HTML interactivity, as you can imagine, is a pain in the ass. We have a bunch of JavaScript, but it's still a pain in the ass. And so debugging is one of these things where you actually need sort of fairly high interactivity, so it's fairly hard to do. We have ways around it. You can see your stack trace and things like that. But if you say break, there's no sense in which you can break out to anything. We have to like spin out a new window or something. You could do it, but we're not good enough at JavaScript. Okay, we'll get back to that in a second. We've discovered that various core algorithms of the various lists that we're using are n squared, n to the m, you know, kind of thing that unless you pour a huge knowledge base into them, you don't notice.
You're talking about the intersection.
Actually, very close. We'll get back to it. Yeah, actually, the best example was CNUCR's SBCL. SBCL's all strings hashed to the first four characters of the string, which in our knowledge base, the first four characters were dollar go dot. The entire genealogy was hashing to the same point, right? This is the most interesting issue here, is that the users are sharing the list image, and that has pros and cons. One of the pros is users sharing the list image. One of the cons is users are sharing the list image, right? And so name management is multiple people. You know, the usual things you can imagine. We actually users are separated by their package, right? So it actually works amazingly well. I mean, nobody ever uses packages. It's an incredible facility, and it works really well unless somebody walks on somebody else, right? Or unless, well, this is actually not package related. I'll go to this one first. Unless you want high security. Because, you know, it's a completely open system. There's no sense of, you know, the package being locked to another person being seeing it. This one, thread management issues, has nothing to do with the packages, but it's a similar idea. So, like, if let's decide to do a GC, a whole space GC, everybody stops, right? So it's not really conformant to what you imagine to be a, you know, modern operating system in a sense. But it's, you know, this is essentially the biggest problem we have is the GC hangs everybody for a few seconds. And we won't run multiple users on it regularly, and the thing's been up forever. So Nero actually was up for a month and a half until Stanford had a power failure on the server. So near and long-term goals. What are we going to do with this? Well, we had this idea. We want to build community resources because it's really designed to be something that a community of biologists or scientists or analysts of any sort can use. And we were trying to figure out ways for them to share stuff, right? So we have various sort of shared files. We tried to use the clicky, and in fact, I think we had the most clever use of the clicky ever, which is that you would write your code like this. You would write your Lisp init in the clicky, and it would go out to your clicky file and, you know, pull it in. Unfortunately, the clicky is not really very good. It's sort of like one of these n squared algorithms. When you have multiple users using it for lots of things, it's really not something you can ramp up. You really need something more powerful than that. So we're still searching for ways to get kind of community resources. Persistence. So persistence, everyone wants true persistence. Until they get it. So I used to, I built UNIVAC's APL interpreter, my own hands, hundreds of users. So I know from where I speak that persistence is both the godsend and the bane of those who have it. Because if you screw yourself and you didn't keep a backup copy, persistence, you're persistently screwed. this sort of apparent persistence seems to be kind of the right level to be at the moment. However, we do have an envisioned approach to getting closer to true persistence. We want to get to this point of having this kind of knowledge CBS, where as you change things, you check a new piece of knowledge. In order to do that, you have to have a huge knowledge space, right, and a persistent knowledge system. So a huge knowledge space equals 64-bit machine. And we're working on, and seem to be working out, to use the Allegro cache ACL, essentially persistent knowledge base. There are, you know, if you built a frame system that has all this flexibility, there are some issues, but it's not a good problem. We can talk more about persistence. Alternatives to having to type code. right? Everyone wants not to have to type parentheses. So Mike Travers has envisioned this system called Behave, which is a clever way of getting sort of the properties of iconic affordances without losing the flexibility of really having code. Because usually, if you have iconic affordances, you lose the kind of loop interaction flexibility that Dr. McCarthy was talking about actually just a couple of days ago. Loops are actually important to be able to write, nested loops, conditions and stuff like that. So how do you get both kind of iconography and the affordances and the ability to do nested loops and things? And so Mike has envisioned this thing called Behave, which is essentially a cross between something that you sort of a drag and drop interface and a programming language. You drag things, it knows the types of things. Mike can tell you much more about this. I'm just going to whiz by it. And then you end up with a piece of code. So this amounts to the piece, this is sort of approximately that piece of code built using Behave instead of the parameters. But in fact, what you really want is more like what Henry Lieberman was talking about, right? So we're working with Richard Waldinger and since Mark Stickle wrote SNARK, the theorem prover, to get actually closer to being able to remember the prime directive, to be able to have things defined this way and not have to put them in like that. The way we do this, actually, we being Richard and Richard Waldinger primarily, is so we've taken this and translated it to a simpler form, right? And so some of this is vaporware and some of it is real. I'll try and tell you where the vaporware is and where the real, okay? So the manual translation of this is just English to English. So we turned it into a simpler English form, right? So list all the genes that pertain to some organism and have orthologs. This is the thing you saw before. Have orthologs in another, and the Hikaru ratio is actually, so Hikaru is one of those time series data sets that Marco was talking about. So it's a time series microarray data set, essentially. So they have a ratio in a data set greater than 2. So that's some metric. Doesn't matter. So there's a system called Gemini in this picture. There's Gemini. Gemini on the left hand edge, which takes the query and turns it into a bunch of uninterpretable stuff. Right? That part sort of works in certain constrained cases. Don't worry about reading this because you're not supposed to read it. Some piece of vaporware turns that into a slightly more interpretable assertion. Right? And Mark can correct me if I get some of this wrong, because I'm describing stuff I only know vaguely, I only know on the edges. And he's been really working on it. So you now have an assertion, right? If you negate the assertion and then do refutation theorem proving, you get the refutations. Right? The refutations turn out to be the answers. So you can go from, in this vision, from this through logic, also through a logical form, to a set of answers from refutation. Refutation resolution theorem. Almost done. I'm going to list a set of, these are basically a real running servers that people are using, the stuff I talk about. There are a bunch of them proposed. The Stanford Genome Tech Center has this enormous project centering around Biolingua to do a human version of it across multiple processors, all kinds of stuff. There is this idea of doing biocache, which is actually going to do what I was talking about this morning. This was all originally funded by NASA to do Space Sciences Discovery Platform. They still don't have their Space Sciences Discovery Platform after 3 years, but they're going to give us more money to continue trying to make a Space Discovery Platform, maybe. We're not sure what that means. But and then Penn State wants to build a community hypothesis browser. These are all the people that have been involved. It's not all the people. There are other people that have been involved in this and are supporting agencies, and back to my little, so you may think that this is crazy, but if you do think this is crazy, I'm sorry for wasting your time. If you don't think this is crazy, and this is something that you actually think that you could, would like to use, would like to have of your own, would like to, use for your own work, would like to deliver your own applications through one of these servers to your user community, it's open source, we'd love to have you work on our code, we'd love to have you copy it and put up your own instantiation somewhere. And that's it. We have a minute for questions, Mike?
Yeah.
Minute for questions.
You said open source, what license?
MIT license.
Okay.
You can do anything you want with it.
Fantastic.
How do you do synchronization to off-server databases?
They each have a different synchronization methodology. We just program, right? So essentially, if somebody has a database they want to use, then we figure out whatever the synchronization. But the idea again is to give access to biologists at the level they don't have to see any of that crap, right?
So we have to program maybe arbitrary synchronization in the thing. It can, they're all different, right? So part of the reason for all of this is that everything is, you know, remember that picture I showed you before, like everything is different. How many of you in here do bioinformatics at all? Raise your hands. Okay. How many of you think that this is really a description of the way things really are? Okay, so notice it's all the same people. Right. So our goal is not to get to just get away from this. I'm just going to run it all in core, and then it's not that big. And if you can't load it in core, have a convenient access to it. Go.
And there's a. Are you familiar with the bioelement out of Caltech?
Yes.
It's similar to this.
Right. The difference is primarily that it actually doesn't have. So the important part of this is the kind of script through the listener. Right? So you can just write the funds right into the listener, and you write your own scripts over the, and it doesn't have that as far as I know. As far as I know, there are things like that, but not this. Go ahead.
I was wondering, if you're listening and your users go straight to the interpreter, are you afraid of them doing something malicious? Or
no. List programmers are not evil. Right. List. There are no, using the neologism hacker, which, forgive me, there are no list hackers. That's our safety valve. Right? Essentially, basically it's not popular enough for people to care, right? But they used to say that about Linux. Oh, Linux is the safest system in the world. Well, now, there's worms and all kinds of stuff all over it. But the general answer is yes, we care. We are working on, security. Allegro Serve had a layer of security, HTTPS, we could get a little bit more security. Right now, it's just logging security, as usual. Okay.
There are problems with people doing silly things. Not malicious things, but silly things. Or just breaking the system because of something else. Like, if you happen to probe file of a 50,000 long string, which you accidentally didn't mean to because it was a genome, 5 million base pairs, and you did a probe file on it, then the system will crash, or at least it used to.
Because
you can buffer overflow.
Right. More reasonably, if you just write an infinite loop, right, then the thread system will run the thread forever, and we hope we depend on the time slicing, which actually works moderately. But you can handle it smart.
Just because this as well as I do, but this is about 50% of what's interesting about Lambda, and the decisions that.
Yes, that's exactly right. Except they did it in this completely useless domain, right?
No, they've used that for, they've used Lambda or Astro VR, for instance.
Oh, yes, that's what the yes, you're exactly right. That's exactly right. That's the part of what the sort of how we kind of got connected to NASA. That's exactly right.
But Pavel went away from using Steam as the basis,
right,
for Moves. Lambda Moves for primarily the.
Go ahead.
Very impressive. The first was interested with the genomics in queries, functions, right. But it occurs to me that the name genomics is basically the original digital language. And is it? Do you think that?
Oh no. Yeah, no. I mean, you're right about it being the original digital language. But we do this in all kinds of other domains. So the machinery underneath this, what I do, another half of my seven hands of my life is. Working on on biological discovery mechanisms, very much like what Marco was talking about, and those are basically big graph algorithms, right, over microarray data and stuff like that, and that's not the original digital language. So it works perfectly well in that. I mean, what I thought you were going to say, which is a reasonable complaint, if you're right about the genomics, which is sort of a really reasonable complaint, is, well, you just built all this stuff to be easy for people. But the idea is to enable them to then build some more stuff, right? And Jeff Elvie is a existence proof that they can do that, right? I don't need to be criticizing your criticism of me, but
I was just curious whether it's unnaturally easy to do it in that domain. It might be a little harder than some others.
Well, I'm sure you can find a hard domain, but these microarray graph model domains and the genomics domains are completely separate. They're really very different things. One is walking graphs and all this kind of stuff, and microarray mathematics. And the other one is, as you say, is the digital. One more question.
You said that HTML's lack of dynamism was a bit of a problem with you, for you guys. Would you be willing to cause people to download a Firefox plugin that had a list interpreter?
Yes.
Because
we'll finish this conversation.
I asked because I'm with Lispnik. We got a Summer of Code proposal that people wanted to do.
So I would love to have somebody work with us to do that exact thing, and then you know we could do all the kind of cool stuff we want to do and have dynamic HTML without having to write JavaScript.
To what extent do you use the ability of this to deal very directly with this code?
Oh, completely.
And
so,
the second along the same line, to what extent is the logic integrated with this?
The logic is becoming more integrated with the list. It's now integrated with the list only in the sense that inside the logical formulas, it calls into the Lisp code, but the as far as I know, the Lisp doesn't code walk the logic or vice versa. But we have lots of machinery in the system that attempts to do pieces of code walk. I'll show you a simple one to enable the user to give kind of user facilities. So for example, here's an example. Mike is trying to shut up. But so here's an example. Well, it's not the best example. The answer is essentially. I can't answer it in 1 minute. We can talk afterwards. So you have access to a macro facility that enables you to write whole new languages. Right? And also the listener code walks to a small extent what the expert you type in, including the definitions, right? And figures out things about it. But JP can tell you more about that. All right, thank you very much.